Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I'm delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Max Blumenthal. He is a blogger, a reporter, a producer of wonderful YouTube videos on occasion. He is the author of a book called Republican Gomorrah and of a new book that I highly recommend that we will be discussing on this program called Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Max Blumenthal, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Great to be on with you, David.
So all kinds of questions about this book, which I find just a staggering portrait of negative, disastrous trends in the nation of Israel. But what was your purpose in writing this book and publishing this book? What do you hope that it does?
What I hope it does is pretty unrealistic, but what I set out to do was basically present Americans with a really ground-level image, ground-level portrayal, possibly the most intimate portrayal that I could muster through 4 years of extended research and journalism on the ground of what they're paying for in Israel-Palestine and what their money is doing to Jewish Israelis and Palestinians. I didn't really talk about the geopolitics. I didn't go into one state versus two state or engage in these familiar debates. Instead, I showed what, you know, the special relationship and what Israel's system of ethnocracy that we're propping up is doing to people on the ground, people from the border police I met at a base in the occupied West Bank that I slipped into by posing as a human rights counselor. And, you know, I described their lives and introduced readers to Alex, who is the only volunteer for one of the most brutal border patrol units operating in the West Bank, who said that he volunteered because he was basically dumped in a poor development town in Israel after emigrating from Kazakhstan, being promised benefits by the Jewish Agency. Became a juvenile delinquent like many of his neighbors, and was beaten by the police and brutalized by the police so much that he decided he wanted to be on the other side of the law, that he wanted to, as he said, be on the other side of the violence. I introduced people like Yonatan Shapira, who is a former Israeli combat pilot who organized the pilot's letter of refusal in the Second Intifada, starting him on kind of a journey of the journey of a Jewish Israeli dissident who was raised to be this alpha male military hero who has wound up becoming one of the leaders of the international movement to boycott and sanction Israel. And I write about his round of interrogations by the Israeli General Security Service, known as the Shin Bet. I talk about so many Jewish Israeli activists who are now under surveillance, including middle-aged, middle-class women from New Profile, this organization that counsels Israeli youth who want to resist Israeli military service and have been brought in for interrogations, had their computers seized. One of them is the daughter of one of the most famous Holocaust survivors to have emigrated to Israel. So this is tearing up the fabric of middle-class society in Israel, and I write about the Palestinians who are leading unarmed protests in the West Bank, like Bassem Tamimi, who before I interviewed him was facing another prison sentence simply for resisting the theft of his land by a nearby settlement by organizing protests every Friday. And I stay in his village with another family waiting for a raid whose children are being arrested at night. And soon after the raid, one of the young men that the army was searching for was shot in the face with a tear gas shell and killed, Mustafa Tamimi, and he fell to the ground with nothing but a slingshot in his hand. This is the kind of violence that Palestinians are facing just for doing Gandhi, as the Israeli general Amos Gilad said. So, you know, I'm creating portraits of so many people in this book who seemingly have little in common, because some are Jewish Israeli, some are poor, some are wealthy, Some are Palestinian Muslims. Some are secular Palestinians just like me, who are like my drinking buddies in Ramallah. But all of them are living under this kind of regime of separation with no defined borders, where one ethnicity is privileged against all others. And they are, and I show that the heavy price they pay for resisting this regime of separation, and the, and really what it takes to make such a consequential decision, which really goes to a larger analysis of why so few Jewish Israeli youth dare to challenge this system, and why right now the West Bank is relatively quiet. The Gaza Strip is actually relatively quiet because the price is so high when you choose to cross the line and resist the kind of violence that Israel wields to protect its system of ethnocracy.
I was struck by the fact that much of the harassment and hostility and abuse documented in the book is not actually coming from the Israeli military or the Israeli government, but from ordinary civilians, that in fact
right.
this is an apartheid society that is enforced by the public. You describe crimes that go unpunished or very, very lightly punished, including crimes up to lynching of individuals. This was a big part of the story, was it not?
This is probably a bigger part of the story than military violence, than the kind of conventional violence, but we have to recognize that. And I'm glad you asked that question. No other interviewer has asked me about that. But vigilante violence, settler terrorism, this serves a really important purpose in Israeli society right now, because what many Jewish Israelis are seeking, especially of the younger post-Oslo generation, is an Arab-free state. And so this kind of violence is designed to sort of support this a state policy that is aimed at ethnic cleansing, at forcing non-Jews out of areas that Jewish Israelis have claimed for themselves, especially in mixed cities. And the ultimate mixed city is Jerusalem. You always hear Israeli politicians talk about Jerusalem as a united city. This means that Jerusalem will never be divided to create room for a Palestinian state with a capital in East Jerusalem. It also means that, you know, that the city doesn't have a wall in it. The wall that you see in the West Bank is actually encircling Jerusalem on its eastern flank to kind of enclose Israeli major settlement blocks into the what could be the future borders of Israel. So Palestinians in East Jerusalem are the ultimate victims of vigilante violence, of settler violence, but also of violence from common Israelis. And this became a phenomenon near where I stayed for 3 months in central Jerusalem, in Zion Square, in what many American Jews consider the spiritual heart of the Jewish people. And I filmed a video with a journalist named Joseph Baena called Feeling the Hate in Jerusalem that showed the kind of racism and incitement and the really fascistic attitudes of Jewish youth in that area, not just Israelis, but American Jews who go there to drink and party and impress their Israeli counterparts. And people, a lot of journalists either dismissed or attacked this video, and Jewish pundits said this, you know, doesn't reflect on Zionism, it's, you know, a disgusting piece of exploitation. But you know, only a few months after we filmed it, there was a young man named Hussam Rawidi who was walking home with his friend, and two Jewish youth stabbed him to death for reason, stabbed him in his neck. They were wearing scarves, these Jewish youth, signifying the Jerusalem football team, Beitar Jerusalem, which is popular among lots of right-wingers like Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman. Whenever Beitar Jerusalem scores a goal, the fanatics of this team, known as La Familia, which have staged regular riots against Arabs in Jerusalem, chant death to Arabs. That's kind of their chant. There's a player named Salim Tuama, who plays for Sakhnin, which is an Arab a team in an Arab village up north in Israel. And whenever he plays, they chant, "Salim, Salim, you're a son of a bitch." They attack the buses of Sakhmin's players. And so these kids were kind of acting out the violence they see on the soccer pitch by stabbing this kid to death. He ran into a restaurant begging for help while he was bleeding to death, and no one did anything. It was in the center of Jerusalem. Then a few months later, after that, Jamal Julani, a 19-year-old Palestinian youth, was walking through Zion Square when he was set upon by 15 Jewish Israeli youth who beat him into a coma. They had heard rumors that he had hit on a 15-year-old Jewish girl. She actually was spreading false rumors to incite violence. And this is the result of the growth of Israel's anti-miscegenation movement. There is a growing movement in Israel led by settlers, but funded by the state, directly funded by the state, to discourage Jewish-Arab relationships and to warn Jewish women that Arab men will seek to kidnap them, take them to their villages and rape and beat them and force them to cheer for suicide bombings. And propaganda is distributed throughout mixed cities in Israel warning women of this possibility. I actually, on my last trip to Jerusalem, which was last month in September, encountered three very approachable, affable Jewish Israeli youth in this area, right off Zion Square. And I sat down in a cafe with them and talked to them about the classes that they go through in high school where they learn about the dangers of dating Arabs. So this is completely reminiscent of, you know, 1940s Alabama, but it's being played out inside the Jewish state with innocent Palestinians as victims and Americans as the all-American taxpayers as the benefactor.
We're speaking with Max Blumenthal about his new book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Max, you mentioned a comparison to Alabama decades back, but comparing what Americans today think of as a right-wing Tea Party movement out of control with what you describe in Israel today, the American version looks a little apathetic and astroturfed and much of a pretense in some ways compared to what you describe in Israel. How would you compare the success of right-wing, not to say fascistic, ideas and actions in Israel and in the United States?
There are connections. There are direct connections. But, you know, I don't, first of all, see the right-wing in Israel as the ultimate problem. And there's the interesting thing is, you know, in the governing Likud party, there is a liberal wing, which is sort of being extinguished. But there are people like Reuven Rivlin, who was an eighth generation Israeli Sabra. That means he's from the original generation that colonized historic Palestine that came in 1893. His father translated the Quran. He speaks Arabic. He's in favor of the settlement movement, but at the same time, He believes that, you know, Palestinians have a place in the land of historic Palestine, and he rejects this regime of separation, of walls and of permits, and of Israel-only highways. That's really the legacy not of the Likud party, but of the Zionist left. What the right wing in Israel has mostly done is contributed bellicose rhetoric. But it's the Zionist left and the socialist wing of the Zionist movement that's responsible for the ethnic cleansing of 750,000 Palestinians in 1948. Many of them readily admit that they did this because this is what it took to create a demographic majority of Jews and establish a Jewish state. They're proud of that legacy to some degree. Of course, they refer to it as a war instead of a conquest. It was the Zionist left that carried out the occupation of the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and the Golan Heights in 1967. And I write in my book about how the intellectual luminaries of the Zionist left gathered in cafes in Tel Aviv to prepare the Greater Israel Statement, where they declared, and most of these people were sort of secular atheists, that the West Bank was the historic cradle of the Jewish state and that they could never give it up because it's like giving up their soul. So they endorsed this occupation. It was the Mapai and Mapam, the antecedents of today's Labor Party, that built the original settlements, that laid the plan for the original settlements around Jerusalem. And so, you know, even though the Likud party kind of inched its way into power in 1977, it's really the Labor Party that's responsible for the construction of this kind of ethnocratic state and for the system that many people who visited there and you know, legal observers has described as open apartheid. So what the Likud party is doing now with its help from the Russian-dominated Yisrael Beiteinu and the right-wing settler parties is really kind of finishing the job. And Netanyahu is benefiting enormously from the blueprint that the Labor Party put into action. He's benefiting from the fact that that the Palestinians of the West Bank and Gaza were surrounded with fencing and barriers under Yitzhak Rabin, who is portrayed as this man of peace in the U.S., under Shimon Peres, who hangs out with Bill Clinton at these galas and gets Nobel Peace Prizes, and under Ehud Barak. And now Netanyahu has kind of established a one-way peace where Israelis are partying on the beach in Tel Aviv, they're facing Europe, and the Arab world is far, far away. Syrians are killing each other, but they're living the good life and making lots of money in the tech sector. That's really the source of Netanyahu's support. And he's able to divert the world's attention from the Palestinian issue, number one, because Israelis don't care about it anymore. You don't hear the Labor Party talking about a two-state solution or the peace process anymore. And so he's got the world focused on Iran. And so it's really this historical progression from socialist Zionist dominance to the dominance of parties that include people who are just open fascists, like Moshe Feiglin, who has become a deputy speaker of the Knesset and favors an Arab-free theocracy in Israel and is a leading member of the Likud party now. These people are just kind of have been handed the baton by the founders of the Jewish state, and they're running with it, supplying it with energy and dynamism, while 1 million Israelis live abroad and want to turn their back on what's becoming a totally dystopia.
What about Israelis who haven't left, who are in Israel? Where does public opinion come down? In the United States, it's not uncommon for the U.S. government to take horrendously horrible actions opposed by 80 or 90% of the public. I don't get that impression from reading your book that the Israeli public is overwhelmingly opposed to the direction that its government is going. What does the polling or other means of learning suggest?
The Jewish Israeli public is generally supportive of the direction that their government is taking their country and the direction their country is going in. They are subjected to completely different factors and a dramatically different environment than Americans are, who are much less unified in their opinions and generally much less happy about the way things are going. Of course, unlike Israelis, we don't have a national healthcare system, so that might have something to do with it. But Israelis, beginning at age 4, are subjected to sustained, constant indoctrination into a culture of militarization, where they're groomed to be good soldiers, because all Israelis, including women, are conscripted into the military. Israel is the only country in the world that conscripts women other than Eritrea. And they're taught what their roles are supposed to be in the military. Parents start deciding what unit their child should be by the time the kid is in elementary school. I write about a group of children in Holon, which is a suburb of Tel Aviv, who are lined up before a board in their classroom. And the board says, "Who wants to kill us?" And it lists Arabs, Nazis, Persians, and various groups that have killed Jews throughout history going back 4,000 years. Then each group, there's a line pointing to a phrase, to a question. What do we need? and then another line, a state. So this is what four-year-olds are being subjected to in preschool. By the time Jewish Israeli youth are 17, many of them are taken on the March of the Living, which is a march through the heart of Auschwitz, the site of mass Jewish extermination by the Nazis, alongside Israeli soldiers and Israeli policemen. And they're taken on sort of a tour of indoctrination, which ends with in a gas chamber, in a candlelit kind of ceremony, where the kids are asked to take on the personas of Jews who are young Jews, children who are killed in the gas chambers of Auschwitz. And by then, they're sort of broken. And all polls show that coming in, Jewish Israeli high schoolers have deep questions, serious questions, skepticism about the culture of militarization and about going into the army and what they're going to have to do. But coming out of this process, their opinions of the army are dramatically more positive, and their sense of nationalism is completely secure. So the Holocaust is exploited. I write about this extensively in my book. It's a central theme. The Holocaust is really exploited to reinforce this culture of militarization, which is dedicated to the domination and control of Palestinians. The Palestinians are portrayed as the heirs to the Nazis. And if you listen to Netanyahu's last speech, major national security speech he gave in Israel at Bar-Ilan University, the base of the religious nationalist movement, and Americans were not exposed to this really remarkable speech. He spent half the speech blaming Palestinians for the final solution for the mass extermination of Jews, and claims that the Palestinians are infected with a poisonous tumor that has to be removed, the tumor of anti-Semitism, before there can be peace. So this is the kind of atmosphere that many Jewish Israelis are forced to grapple with, and it's very hard for them to find a way out of it and to counter the Zionist narrative. Only about 20% of the Jewish Israeli population, according to Daniel Bartal, the professor of political science at Tel Aviv University, is able to kind of form an alternative narrative. But even then, many of them become subjected to peer pressure and self-censorship. So we're talking about a society that, while it claims to be democratic, educates its youth and its citizenship into clearly anti-democratic culture aimed at reinforcing militarization and, frankly, a colonial system that's out of step with the direction that American society is going in.
So what do you say, Max, to critics who predictably and relentlessly respond that both sides are wrong, the Palestinians are violent, the Arab nations are anti-democratic and anti-Semitic? How dare you just criticize Israel? It isn't fair and balanced. How do you respond to these sorts of critiques?
Well, that's a good question, and I've been forced to respond to it a lot, because critiques of these critiques are not very sophisticated usually. But, you know, there is good and bad on both sides. I would never portray Israel as bad and the Palestinians as good. That's not the issue. There are Palestinians I don't like, and there are Jewish Israelis I do like. But the issue is not, so the issue is not good and bad. The issue is oppressor and oppressed. And since 1893, there has been a project to colonize historic Palestine and to either ethnically cleanse or ghettoize its indigenous residents by a non-indigenous population of Jewish immigrants to establish an exclusively Jewish state. And this is played out through occupation, but it's also played out inside the Green Line through policies of institutional discrimination that I really spend, pages and pages highlighting in my book, showing what life is like for the Palestinian citizens and the Bedouin citizens of Israel. So, I mean, the issue from a liberal or left-wing American standpoint, you have to kind of stand on the side of people who are being oppressed, whose future is being destroyed. who are being thrown off their land. And, you know, I gave a talk in Oklahoma, and a Republican challenged me, and I said, you know, what would you do if, and this is Oklahoma, most of the people there, many of the people there have farming backgrounds or have family and friends who have farms. And I said, what would you do if foreign army came and literally occupied your farm and threw you off your farmland and denied you your, you know, the business that sustained your family for generations? Would you take up arms? And he didn't really have an answer. He kind of clammed up. And I said, the most violent movie in Hollywood history is Red Dawn by George Milius. It's this, you know, anti-communist exploitation flick that Americans loved, which shows a Soviet occupation of the U.S. where a group of American farmers take up arms against their occupiers and kill them by the thousands. So I think once Americans can put themselves in the shoes of Palestinians and see what they've had to deal with, and Americans can recognize their own these anti-colonial traditions that they've been raised on, educated on, they can begin to identify with them, and then they should really be impressed, because the dominant Palestinian position, in my view, is not violent resistance but restraint. They've shown incredible restraint against enormous violence, and I portray the people in villages that have had their land robbed from them right under their feet, right before their eyes, including the village of Nalin, which had a wall built through the center of the village, and they now look at their olive trees that they own on the other side in the front yards of settlers and try to, you know, they have a deep connection with these olive trees, and they want to see the olives are growing, but they can't reach them. Instead of taking up arms, this village has walked into the phalanxes of Israeli soldiers holding protest signs and been met with percussion grenades, with rubber bullets, and with tear gas shells, and endured dozens and dozens, hundreds of casualties, hundreds of arrests, and they keep going every week. So that's something that Americans should relate to and admire.
And of course, those tear gas canisters carry labels that say "Made in the United States of America," and the Israeli military's abuses, as you note on this program and in the book, are funded by the U.S. taxpayer. The book is absolutely phenomenal, 400 pages, and every page worth reading. It's called Goliath: Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. The author is Max Blumenthal. Max, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
David, thanks so much for having me.
One of the weapons Israel has used to kill hundreds of people in Gaza is the unmanned drone. This week, the UN and Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have all released reports on drones, showing that U.S. drone strikes have killed hundreds of civilians, and many of those strikes in violation of the law, as these reports see it. But Human Rights Watch looked in detail at 6 drone murders and found 2 illegal and 4 it couldn't say. Amnesty looked at 9 and couldn't decide on the legality or illegality of any of the 9. The UN reports warn that drones are making war the norm rather than the exception. And yet the same reports accept that some drone murders are legal. They shouldn't be. Go to banweaponizeddrones.org and help ban them. Banweaponizeddrones.org. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.